Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about politics of the Middle East. And this is the first of three programs that we'll be doing now over about the next week or so, in an effort to try to talk about things from three different perspectives. We acknowledge the fact that there are probably more than just three, but three at least we will be presenting. And this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Baruch Benah. He is the Consul General of Israel to the Midwest and has been a member of Israel's Foreign Service since 1979. He is based in Chicago, and he is responsible for Israel's political and public diplomacy efforts in 11 states, Illinois, of course, also Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. I do want to mention just very quickly before we begin talking with Baruch Benah that we'll do two shows next week, I'm sure, talking about some of the same subjects. Next week on Tuesday in the 11 o'clock hour, our guest will be Zev Maoz. He's professor of political science at the University of California at Davis and also is professor of government at Tel Aviv University. And then next week, Wednesday in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with Rashid Khalidi. He's a president of Arab Studies at Columbia University and has written a lot about the politics of within the Palestinian movement. So these programs coming up, each one an opportunity to hear from guests and also to ask questions. And certainly that is possible here this morning. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments. Remember, you're sharing the space with others. We'd like to give an opportunity to as many different people as possible to call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, you use that first number. And then if it would be a long-distance call, no matter where you might be listening, you can use the second. So again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Good morning, Mr. Benah.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. There are a number of things that I would like to try to talk about and give you the opportunity to,
yes,
to talk about. I suppose the place to begin, always the place to begin, has to do with the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians and the possibility for some kind of long-term stable peace. Now, of course, complicated by what happened Wednesday in the Gaza Strip, although I'm sure that there's probably always something that's coming along to complicate this relationship. In Beit Hanun in the Gaza Strip yesterday, some people were killed by an Israeli artillery shell. Apparently, this was an accident, but it was a tragic accident. And now, once again, it looks as if we have something that's pushing off the possibility of talks between the governments of the Palestinians and the Israelis to sometime in the future. Can you talk a little bit about, from your perspective and from the perspective of the Israeli government, what it's going to take even to get representatives of both sides just simply to sit down at the same table and to start to talk?
Well, I wish I could say it's very simple because this is a good beginning but for an answer, but it's not so simple at all. I mean, our demands for a resumption of the dialogue are the demands of the international community. That is, that the Palestinian government renounces terrorism, fight against terrorism, accept Israel and its right to exist, and adhere to all existing agreements. Once we have that, there's no problem. Since we do not have that, we will still have a negotiation the moment that it is possible with the elected chairman or president of the Palestinian Authority, Abu Mazen. And I hope that the meeting between our Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Abu Mazen will take place rather shortly. I do wish, though, to take the opportunity and to once again follow in the footsteps of the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister and extend our apologies for the tragedy that happened in Beit Hanun. The army is doing now the investigation what went wrong, probably a computer error or something like that, which took the shells some 500 meters off the mark, off the target, and caused the death of innocent civilians. This is never, ever the goal of Israel, the state of Israel, to cause death among innocent civilians. Unfortunately, it happens in conflicts and in war, and when we are attacked by 1,000 missiles in the last year or so from Gaza, well, mistakes like that can happen when we respond.
There was, I know, back in, it's been a couple of months, but at one point I know that it, that on both sides here were saying that, or perhaps it was in fact Mahmoud Abbas and Ehud Olmert both said, well, in principle, they would be willing to sit down and meet and to talk. Now, this, again, what's happening right now is going to make that sort of difficult, but is it your expectation, or perhaps one would say, as far as you could say, that the government of Israel is interested and willing to do that, to have talks between the Palestinian president and the Israeli prime minister?
Of course, we always are. The problem is that, unfortunately, the Palestinian president or chairman, Abu Mazen, perhaps does not have a lot of power to control what's going on in his own territories. You see, when we withdrew unilaterally from Gaza about a year, 15 months ago, we did so, among other things, to allow the Palestinians the freedom of selecting their own way of life and running their affairs, but not at the price of being able to shoot missiles and rockets at Israel with impunity. So while we will be meeting with the leader of the Palestinian autonomy or authority, we do have some very hard questions. How come that they continue firing rockets and missiles at Israel, and what exactly do they expect from us in order of response? Are we just to say, okay, we understand that this is some kind of an infancy situation and look the other way while you keep shelling us? No. So the situation is complicated, but still we are committed to a meeting between our prime minister and the Palestinian leader. Hopefully, he should be able by that time to put his house in order with Hamas and with other groups, and to form a kind of a government that will be able to actually take control of Gaza and put an end once and for all for the shooting and shelling from Gaza into Israeli territories.
As you suggest, the difficulty on the Palestinian side is that it is extremely divided. It's the leadership is divided between Fatah, which is Mr. Abbas's faction, and Hamas, and then within Hamas, it itself is divided between people who perhaps are more militant and more moderate, if you would even agree to description like that. So it is the Palestinian leadership is extremely divided, and as you say, again, the leaders of Hamas and Fatah are talking about trying to put together some kind of national unity government, which is and will continue to be, I'm sure, very difficult. If that happens, does that make it any more complicated for Israel to then talk with the Palestinian government if Hamas is truly a part of that government?
Well, it all depends on the bottom line. If the bottom line is that there is an end to terrorism, there's an end to rockets fired at Israeli citizens, the villages, excuse me, on the southern part of our border, then it makes things a little easier. If they release the soldier that they have kidnapped, Corporal Gilad Shalit, nearly 4 months ago, that makes it a little easier. But you mentioned, David, that even Hamas is sort of torn into mini factions, and that is indeed the situation. There is a chaos, a governmental chaos, a society chaos right now in Gaza, and they cannot, as always, blame it on us because we are not there. We have not been there for 15 months, and they have to put their house in order. It doesn't seem credible, it doesn't seem real that they want to negotiate with us about future relations without presenting to the world and to Israel a unified understanding on the Palestinian side that life with Israel is something that they would like to have. Right now, they're still committed to the destruction of Israel. I mean, I know it sounds a little bit outlandish, especially if you look at Israel and see how strong and successful it is, but this is what they want, and this is what they're trying to do. So as long as they do not agree to that, even if we discuss as we're willing to do many issues with the Palestinian government, we will know. I'm sorry, with the president of the authority, we will know that behind it there is still a huge potential for terrorism, and we will always have to be very, very vigilant in that respect. Mm.
Let me ask you one further question, and then we have some callers, and I want to bring them in. You talked initially about the fact that, as far as the government of Israel is concerned, the minimal demand, as far as the Palestinians are concerned, is the renouncing of terrorism and that they accept the right of Israel to exist.
And adhere to all previous agreements already signed between Israel and the Palestinians.
And I think that there would be some people who would say that, in fact, most people on the Palestinian side know, while they might not speak it out loud, know that they cannot defeat Israel by force of arms, and that whether they like it or not, Israel will exist. It's simply a fact. And that for that reason, many people have really at least given up on the idea that violence can get them where they want to go. The problem is with them actually coming right out and saying that in a manner to which you would like. In what way, how formally would the Palestinian leadership have to make the statement for it to be accepted to the government of Israel?
Well, first of all, let me stress or highlight the fact that it's not only Israel's demand. This is the demands that were put forward to the Palestinians by the Quartet and by the international community. And the Quartet is not just the United States, not even just the U.S. and Europe. That includes also the United Nations as an international community and Russia. So it's an international demand put forward to the Palestinians that they must accept. Secondly, yes, it has to be very formal, but formalities are not enough, because even if they formally accept all these good things and in fact do not implement them on the ground, and the shelling and the rockets continue, and the smuggling of arms into Gaza through tunnels and through other means continue, then what have we done? We will have another agreement which will look fantastic on paper, and in the end of the day we will have to still alert the population in Ashkelon and Ashdod and Sderot and all these places adjacent to Gaza to hurry up and shelter themselves before another rocket lands in the city square.
Well, let me ask you this question. From your perspective, what is it, do you think, that the Palestinians believe that they stand to gain by doing this? Because obviously, yes, if their goal is to kill some Israelis, they can do that. But that's not going to get rid of the state of Israel. Why do you think they continue to do this?
Well, I believe this is for the historian to decide many years from now, but if I'll try my bit now, and here I will say that they took the wrong lessons from our withdrawal of Lebanon in the summer of 2000, which they saw as a sign of weakness, and all this propaganda talk, excuse me for the expression, as if Israel is just a cobweb that will give way under pressure from terrorism. Otherwise, I cannot explain it, really. In the summer of 2000, when then Prime Minister Ehud Barak was willing to actually risk his political head, as indeed he did, and offer the Palestinians, still under Yasser Arafat, over 90% of the territory center is, so they could create a state there. And even if it wasn't all the 100% that they expected, or even more than the 100% that they accepted, it still was much, much better than they ever had it before. And they opted for starting once again terrorism. I guess they may have thought that Israel, being a Western society, will not be very happy to go to war, and that it will give up in the face of terrorism. And they were surprised, as was Lebanon the Hezbollah in Lebanon, when they decided to try us in the last summer, and we responded in the way that we did. We wait a lot, and we can be very patient, but there comes the time when we have to respond, and that is not so much in terms of retaliation, but rather in terms of taking down or minuting the capabilities, the military capabilities of the other side. And I don't really know what they gain to hope but to terrorize Israel. And what they have to understand is that it's not going to happen. We can be, as I said, very generous in negotiations, but we can be tough as nails when we have to fight.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Baruch Minah. He's a member of Israel's Foreign Service, has been since 1979, and currently he serves as the Consul General of Israel to the Midwest. He is based in Chicago and talking with us this morning by telephone. Questions welcome. I did promise I would not make the callers wait, and we do have several, and we'll get right to them. And again, I would just ask callers to please try and be brief. We do want to get in as many people as we can. We'll start first with someone in Urbana, and this is on line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've got a question about Urbana. I've been wanting to ask somebody for about a year. And I run when Hatami was the president, elected to two terms. He was what they called a reformer. And then, I don't know when it was, less than 2 years ago, they had the election when Ahmadinejad became the president. How did it go from somebody who was supposedly a reformer to someone that is quite the opposite?
Well, this does deal with the politics of another country, but I imagine that. Go ahead, and if I obviously politics in Iran is something that is also of great concern to Israel.
Yeah, indeed,
go ahead, and you can respond however you like.
Well, thank you. Khatami was indeed a reformer in Iranian measurements, and he did. I understand, want to take their society in a more liberal direction, and that was bad news to the Ayatollahs and to the extremes. And in fact, in the last elections, what they did was to disqualify one candidate on the reformer side after the other, and thereby intimidating others which took the names off the ballot. The reason why they did was that they wanted to try again and run once again later on when these days are over. Nobody really knew a lot about Ahmadinejad, who is indeed far more extreme. But I believe that at the time, these measures that the Ayatollahs took against the more reformist camp in Iranian politics was a sign of political despair, because they realized that the public in Iran would like to try another way. I'm not sure, how much we could hope for a better day right now, because when the political process was halted screechingly, abruptly, by disqualifying of the reformist camp, then it will take some time until people will try again. I have to say a word also about the so-called reformist camp. The fact that it was more reform-oriented in Iranian politics and in Iranian society does not mean that it was less anti-Israeli. Of course, we did not hear all these statements about wiping Israel off the map of the world as Ahmadinejad is issuing, but the WMD program, that is the Weapons of Mass Destruction program of Iran, kept continuing and going on, and even under Mr. Khatami. And last word perhaps on Iran is that in any case, it is not the president who calls the shots there. It is the Ayatollah Khamenei who took over from Ayatollah Khomeini, who is called the spiritual leader. And the spiritual leader actually takes a decision. Mr. Ahmadinejad works for him, and it's not the other way around. And so did Khatami. So Iran is still a riddle that evolves in front of our eyes. We hold Iran in high regard. We have had good experience through 2,000 years of history with Iran or with the Farsi people. Jews were welcomed there. Iran made huge contributions to world culture and civilization. Something went wrong, and they have gone berserk when they have adopted Ayatollah Khomeini and everything that came after that in the fundamentalist Muslim or Islamic revolution. We have to outwait it. Iran will return to mankind.
Well, thanks for that explanation and analysis.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go on to, we have someone next in Gibson City wanting to talk with us, line number two. Hello.
Yes, hello. I guess I just want to make a personal comment because I haven't never been to Gaza, but I've been to the West Bank. And I guess it upsets me because we don't hear some of the stories. And one of the things that I see is, first of all, there's a wall that's going around, and it's not on the green line. It goes into the West Bank, and it cuts off children from their schools. It cuts off farmers from their selling their produce and many, many other things. Also, there's places where the Palestinians cannot go. There's roads just for Israelis. The Israeli Defense Force, I've seen them detain men going to the mosque, and they are not able to get there in time for prayer. The Palestinian people have to have special passes to get out of, for instance, Bethlehem. Bethlehem is I think, only has one exit from the now that the wall is around there. And I am a Christian and a pacifist, so I do not believe in violence. But beyond that, there's a lot of inhumane things being done. On the other hand, there's also many Jewish groups that are for peace and justice, and they stand with the Palestinians in not wanting their houses to be demolished and help rebuilding houses and doing many things, helping them in the South Hebron Hills where there are sheep herders. I don't know if our people know it, but last year the settlers poisoned their fields. Internationals, including Israelis, came and helped them clean up the poison. And I guess the thing that I'm trying to say is the Palestinians, it's going to seem like I'm on the Palestinian side, but I am on the side for human beings being treated decently and humane. And if you want to talk about who has the arsenal of weapons, who has... I think Israel has an atomic bomb. I mean, Palestinians have very little, and I don't agree with suicide bombers, and I don't agree with that either. I don't agree in violence, and I don't think it's going to be the governments that are going to get peace in the Middle East. It's going to be the people on both sides that want it, and I don't know, you know, I guess I just, as a person, this is my personal story, and... I can see why the Palestinians do what they do. There's a hopelessness there because no matter what they do, and even in the West Bank, I get very upset.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to talk too much longer. I guess that's just how I feel, and I feel that the story is not being heard. I think you'd do a better job in Israel of telling the news how it's really happening. We don't hear what's really happening. And I think Gaza is really sad, and I think that, you know, the inhumane things being on Gaza, it's like living without electricity and water and then still having the Israeli military on your back. So I don't agree with violence on either sides, and I just want to hear your comment on that.
Well,
how you feel about that.
And
now
I do
hang
wanna,
up and listen.
I thank you for the call. Obviously, the caller has raised a lot of points. You can deal with that as you like.
Yeah, I will try to address it. First of all, I appreciate the caller's emotional distress and being upset. I can assure you, ma'am, that we are very upset ourselves, and that we do not support violence, and in fact we're willing to go a long way in order to avoid violence. You've made many points. Let me try and address as many as I can. About the news, I have to disagree with you. I think that Israel is one of the most, and the territories, are one of the most covered areas in the world. You have a country the size of the state of New Jersey with a foreign press corps of about the size of Washington, D.C., and so anything of importance is being, or even things that are not so important are being aired on the international media in this country, in Europe. Hardly is there a day without a news item from Israel or the territories of both, and I don't think that Russia, for example, or the United Kingdom are being covered as extensively as Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank are. As for groups that do not believe in violence, and the caller mentioned rightly that there are Jewish groups. I would say that the majority of Israelis do not believe in violence. And yes, there are many, many groups and subgroups related to the peace camp, and the peace camp in Israel is very big and very strong. I believe that a major part of the tragedy that befell both our peoples is that there isn't such a parallel on the other side. I don't know of any movement like Peace Now in the Palestinian community. And in fact, ever since our conflict began, I would say about more than 100 years ago, the Jewish side was always like half and half. In support of peace, and the other side was not. Now, with regard to the what the caller called the wall, that is the defense barrier that we have built and we are building around the West Bank, and it's been very helpful in terms of stopping terrorism, and it is not a permanent fixture. It is not a political border. It is just a military tactical asset to stop terrorism. We have done it unilaterally because at some point we came to the conclusion that there wasn't anybody on the other side to help us stopping terrorism. And we are talking about a period 3-4 years ago in which hundreds of Israelis were killed, dozens by the day. And whereas we never target civilians, and when civilians get killed or injured, this is a cause for a commission of inquiry by the State of Israel and by the IDF. The Israeli civilians are the target. They are the target. We are the target as human beings. And my daughters are the target when they go to school. And I have to make sure that they go through the right ways and, you know, where it's less dangerous. We have lost in this intifada about 1,200 lives, most of them civilians. And the government at the time, headed by Ariel Sharon from Likud at the time and Shimon Peres from Labor, did not like the idea of a fence. Ariel Sharon did not want a border, And Shimon Peres wanted an economic unity between us and the Palestinians. But the cry from the public, the pressure from the public was such that the government had to acquiesce. Yes, and it is not going on along the Green Line. The Green Line is not really meaningful. When there is a future state of Palestine established, there will be discussions about the border. There will be an agreement between Israel and that state about where the border goes. And then the fence will be moved accordingly. Right now, the route of the fence is done only on the basis of what is strategically or tactically or topographically important to protect Israel from terrorism. And in the case of our presence in Gaza and in, actually in the West Bank, Gaza has ended, they can, and this is the first time in human history that I know of, that the inhabitants of an occupied area could apply to the Supreme Court of the occupying power. They can actually go to the Supreme Court of Justice, and they can make their plea, and in many cases the Supreme Court of Justice changes the route, and they take into consideration and balance the public good in preventing terrorism against private property rights on the other side. And the government has to abide by the verdict handed down by the Supreme Court of Justice. Now, there were many, many more points that you made, ma'am, but, you know, I could relate to each and any one of them. But let me say something on a more general basis, which I hope will answer most of them all in one. And that is that they have a way out of this situation. If they accept Israel as a country, as a Jewish state in the Middle East, if they renounce terrorism, as they have committed to do and have not done, if they adhere to all the agreements that they have signed, which now they say that they do not want to, then there will be no need for all the presence that we have in the West Bank. There will be no roadblocks, there will be no ways around and circumventing and so on. By withdrawing from Gaza unilaterally 15 months ago, we offered them an opportunity to start somewhere. And we have signaled that this is not going to be the end, because we have also cleared from 4 settlements in the West Bank. They have the chance, and the ball is in their court, and they have to act responsibly. If not, we will continue to bleed. And as the caller mentioned, we are much more formidable in terms of a military power. We hardly use any fragment of it. But if we go to a conflict, then they stand a lot to lose. We have a state. They do not. They could have had it 60 years ago, like we did. They chose the other path. They could still have had it. They can still have it if they act wisely.
We are past our midpoint. In fact, here we're in about our last 15 minutes. Our guest is Baruch Binah. He's the Israel's consul general. He's consul general of Israel to the Midwest, and he's talking with us by phone. He's based in Chicago. We also will be doing 2 more programs, I'm sure, talking about the same subjects with different guests who we are sure will have different points of view. And I just want to mention them again real quick. Next week, Tuesday morning at 11, we'll be speaking with Zev Mose. He's a political scientist. He's now spending some time at UC Davis. He's also a professor of government at Tel Aviv University. He'll be with us here, actually, in the studio. Because he's visiting the campus. And then also we'll be talking next week, Wednesday at 11, with Rashid Khalidi. He's professor of Arab studies at Columbia and has written a lot about the politics of the Palestinian movement. We have other callers, and we'll again try getting as many people as we can, but they'll help us by trying to be brief too. Let's go to line 3. This is Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. On the issue of media representation, MediaEd.org has a great documentary called Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land, which I recommend to everybody's attention. I share the point of view of our Christian Peacemaker Team volunteer who called in just a bit ago about the representation in the media. The World Court was actually also gone to about the wall, and even the American judge, though he had some reservations, agreed that it should be exactly on the green line as opposed to being a land grab, which it is widely seen as in other parts of the world. What I really wanted to ask you about, though, with this accident in Beit Hanoun, what is going on with the French and the German representatives who endowed by the UN to be monitoring the ceasefire in Lebanon? On October 25th, an Israeli jet strafed a German ship. Just today on the BBC, there's a line, French nearly fired at Israeli jets. They've been menacing UN French UN troops in South Lebanon. This seems like an accident waiting to happen, and I don't know whether the disproportionate response in Lebanon was urged on by the U.S. or not, which is widely suggested in some circles that the Cheney. And so I think that U.S. culpability is very important in this regard. I don't know what the truth of that is, but it was an incredibly disproportionate. It's called an attack on Hezbollah. It was actually an attack on Lebanon, sir.
Well, Mr. Binod?
Okay, let me respond. First of all, with regard to the defense barrier, which the caller calls the wall, most of it is not a wall. Most of it, over 90%, is a fence. Barbed wire, what we call a smart fence, with lots of electronics, it's not a wall. It's a wall only in areas when you have, when you do not have enough territory, wide enough to put all this intelligence into the wall, into the barrier. And as I said, it is temporary, and I don't really think that we in Israel need to take the decision of the International Court as such a compelling verdict. We have our own Supreme Court of Justice. We trust it. And I think that that was also the view of the United States. In fact, the only American judge there was supportive of Israel's position. And the International Court of Justice in The Hague did not offer any other solution to terrorism. And in fact, many people expect us just to act by the book while the other side does not. The best remedy to the situation such as the fence is to finalize the agreements between Israel and the Palestinians. And the same goes to the situation in Lebanon. First of all, I totally disagree and flatly disagree with the assertion that we acted there disproportionately. I don't know of any other country that would have taken such a barrage of missiles and rockets on its on major cities. You know, I keep thinking to myself, my God, it was Haifa, Israel's third largest city. Imagine how would your country responded if Chicago, the third largest city here in this country, would have been attacked by long-range and mid-range missiles. I think I know a bit about the way America acts when America is under attack. And so is Israel, and so is any other human society, if it has any sanity at all. But still, when we did that, we alerted the inhabitants, the population, the people of Lebanon, when we were responding in a certain area, when we were taking out missiles and launching pads and headquarters of Hezbollah. And yes, it was a counterattack against Hezbollah, not against the Lebanese people. And this is why we've sent them, we have spread all over the areas leaflets in Arabic saying, in your village, in your area, there is a launching pad. We know it. We're going to take it out. You are best advised to leave the area until hostilities are over. And thereby, by the way, we deprived ourselves of the advantage of surprise. And you know, when the population was leaving, if they did, Hezbollah was ready for us. But still, this is the way that we operate. And we when we look at the casualties in Lebanon, I believe the Lebanese official numbers are around 1,200 to 1,300 fatalities, out of whom there are 500 to 600 Hezbollah members. And who is a civilian and who is not in that respect? One could drive a cab in the morning and then go back home, take the Katyusha rocket from underneath the apple tree, fire at Israel, and go back home and have a cup of coffee. That's very normal in southern Lebanon, and it had to be stopped. And in that respect, I think that our reaction in Lebanon was very, very moderate. With regard to the international forces in Lebanon, again, the main argument that they have with us right now is our overflights in Lebanon. But this is essential until we know for sure that there is a kind of mechanism to make sure that the embargo on Hezbollah, which was stipulated in United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701, is implemented. Because we do not want to have a situation in which Iran and Syria could replenish Hezbollah and just, you know, preparing them for the next round. And we have to know where they deploy. Where are they? Where are the launching pads of the new missiles? Where exactly they are? And the only way to do it is by overflights. And with a German boat, apparently, and I don't know all the military details, but apparently from what I read in Israeli press, first of all, it was already cleared between the two governments. There wasn't really any misunderstanding from the beginning, but according to the rules of engagement or the rules of procedure, they should have informed the IDF when they take off from a ship. And since there was some kind of an aerial movement, IDF Air Force checked the situation, and that was all. There was no strafing, full stop, none at all. And with the French, well, I hear that, but again, what do they want us to do? Not to fly over Lebanon and let Hezbollah restock and redeploy? First, they have to make sure, the international force and everybody else, that Hezbollah is not replenished.
I would expect that you, as a representative of the Israeli government, would defend the action in Lebanon, would certainly reject the notion that the action that Israel took was disproportionate. I'm afraid I would have to also point out that there are a lot of people that would suggest that if you look at the number of people on both sides that were killed, the kind of destruction that was visited on the infrastructure of Lebanon, which some people would argue has set now the development of the country back many years, and would even point to the fact that at least back in August, the human rights group Amnesty International went as far as accusing Israel of committing war crimes in Lebanon, that there are a lot of people that would still be prepared to make a very strong argument that in fact the action that Israel took was not proportionate.
Of course, but it doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it right. And the fact of the matter is that Israel also took a lot of damage, over $600 million. The fact is that we lost over 150 lives in that. And the reason that we lost less, well, I do have to apologize, do I, for the fact that we are an orderly country with shelters and that we took care of our refugees. About a million Israelis had to flee from Galilee and from the northern part of the country and went to the south, and so they were spared. And those who were killed were primarily those who disobeyed the orders not to leave the shelters, or soldiers. In our case, about 120 soldiers were killed, the majority, in fighting and in protecting their country. And to say that there is a similarity here, well, there cannot be a similarity between the those who actually initiate conflict and those who respond in protection of the country. But we do not come crying to the international community, "Oh, help us! We need to rebuild our country." We will rebuild our country.
Well, I want to try to get at least one more caller. We're very short on time. We'll go to Champagne. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah. Without dealing with any of the specific falsehoods that have been consistently stated throughout this program, let me just say that to your listeners that one way to understand this problem is just to look at our own country, to look at the cycle of fear and violence that's generated by our government and our military, and to think of Israel in somewhat the same way. You have an increasing divide of wealth between rich and poor, and under those circumstances, people have to have their mind taken off their problems, and they have to be afraid, and they have to go to war. And we have now in the Israeli government a very hateful man named Avigdor Lieberman who would like to ethnically cleanse Arab citizens from Israel. And this is just another example of the kind of internal scapegoating that goes on in a society in which wealth is divided very unequally. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and people have to have their minds taken off by the enhancement of a perceived threat. It's very interesting, though, to contrast, say, the hatred of immigrants and the scapegoating of immigrants in this country. In Israel, what you have is an immigrant Russian population who has learned to scapegoat the Arab citizens of Israel who have been there for hundreds of years. So it's a perverse situation, and I just hope that people listening to this program do not necessarily reflect poorly on all Jews due to the comments of this guest.
Well, let's again give the guest an opportunity to respond.
Well, thank you. let me just say that, don't assume conspiracy, never assume conspiracy and malice when sheer confusion and lack of planning will do. Nobody really thought about a war. Nobody really was preparing Israel for a war. Economists, I believe, called it the accidental war. Had it not been for the kidnapping of Israeli soldiers from within Israel's territory, not in Lebanon, I have to stress that, within Israel territory, number one, immediately followed by a barrage of over 60 rockets and missiles over northern Israel, we would not have responded. But we found ourselves in a situation where we had to think not only on the provocation, but also on the threat in front of us. For as long as this threat was a kind of abstract, well, I guess some will say wrongfully, erroneously, we did not pay a lot of attention to it and allowed it to grow more and more. But once it presented itself in such a form, we knew that if we do not put a tag price on any attempt to kidnap Israelis, we're going down the slippery slope and everybody will become a potential hostage. With regard to the Arab citizens, in Israel, they are full citizens. They have all the rights. They can vote. They can be voted. On the other hand, they are exempted from military service. So that's a major privilege. And their leadership, I'm afraid sometimes some of them do not really cater for what is good for the voters. It seems to me sometimes that they are actually catering to the taste of other organizations outside of Israel, and they would like to issue all these statements against Israel, against the country in its own parliament, in which parliament serve as members of parliament. But I guess this is why we have parliamentary immunity for as long as it is their right. It is their right. With regard to the new minister in the government, let me just say that there had been no changes in the government policy, and the new party that has joined the government right now accepted all the existing policies and platforms upon which the parties that make the coalition have agreed at the beginning of this government. I don't like it when people try to portray my country as a kind of a diabolic entity that is manipulative and so on. We are a country of simple people honest-to-God people who try to work, who try to maintain our country as the beautiful place that it is, to make it a fun country, which we believe it is, and a Jewish state and a democracy. And it's very hard to round all these corners into one entity in a democratic way. We try our best, and like many other countries, sometimes we blunder, sometimes we succeed. On the whole, I think that we're doing a good job.
We are going to have to stop. I'm sorry, we had some other calls we simply cannot take. We will, however, continue to talk about these issues, I'm sure, with other guests next week. Again, I want to mention real quick, on Tuesday we'll be talking with an Israeli political scientist, Zev Maus. He'll be visiting here at the campus, and also then an Arab-American political scientist, Rashid Khalidi, who's written a lot about the Palestinian movement and its politics. That'll be on Wednesday, so again, an opportunity to continue to ask questions and hear some different viewpoints. For the moment, we want to say thanks to our guest, Baruch Binah. He is the Consul General of Israel to the Midwest. He's based in Chicago. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to talk to your listeners.